Chapter 7 Modern Robber Barons. Ron's, a restaurant in Hampton Beach, New Hampshire, is just down the street from the Ashworth Hotel, where I worked as a bellhop the summer after my senior year in prep school. "This is the joint the whole world's read about," Charles said as we took our seats at a table in Ron's with a view of the Atlantic. A native to Hampton Beach and a student at the nearby University of New Hampshire, he and I had met when I lectured at his school shortly after the publication of Confessions. The place where our own local economic hitman, Dennis Kozlowski, hung out with his mistress, Karen Lee Mayo. She was a waitress here, married to a lobsterman, Rich Locke. Everyone knew her. His appreciative whistle was soft enough that the people at the next table never raised an eyebrow. A real looker. Could have doubled for Kim Basinger. In my youth, I wished for something that would put my native state on the map. Back then, you would have been laughed out of the room if you had suggested anything as outlandish as the idea that an infamous tycoon would choose sleepy New Hampshire as a location for a couple of his conglomerate's factories, his own office, and for a romance that would bounce off the tabloids onto the pages of the Wall Street Journal and Fortune. Charles handed me a copy of a December 2002 Business Week article, with the following words highlighted. "With every passing month, Tyco International Limited's, TYC, Leo Dennis Kozlowski looms larger as a rogue CEO for the ages. His $6,000 shower curtain and vodka-spewing full-size ice replica of Michelangelo's David will not soon be forgotten. At the office, too, Kozlowski's excess was legendary. He was the most prolific corporate acquirer ever, gobbling up 200 companies a year, nearly one every business day, at the height of his hyperactivity." The article neglects to mention, Charles said, that vodka was spewed from David's penis, like piss, or that it was displayed at Karen Lee's birthday party on the island of Sardinia, and she was by then his wife. He sat back and stared out the window in the direction of the Atlantic Ocean, shaking his head sadly. "Now, I ask you, what kind of man decorates his wife's birthday party with a statue that pees vodka, a replica of one of the art world's most important icons at that, complete with an oversized schlong?" Then he looked at me. "Kind of makes the robber barons of the 19th century's Gilded Age look innocent, don't you think? And Kozlowski is one of many. There's a whole crop of CEOs out there that are just as bad, or even worse." Kozlowski has since been indicted on two sets of charges, convicted, and sentenced to prison. But so many greedy CEOs like him continue to go free, ensconced in their multi-million-dollar mansions, paid for on the backs of their employees, customers, and the public, you and me. Charles's point was well made. The collective avarice and abuses by modern-day tycoons have left their 19th-century predecessors sprawling in the dust of history. Kozlowski's profligacy is symbolic of the similarities between now and the Gilded Age, when captains of industry and finance like Jay Cook, Daniel Drew, James Fisk, Henry Clay Frick, and J.P. Morgan reigned. Like them, CEOs today wield great power in both local and national governments and live extravagant lifestyles, often underwritten by the companies they run. Tyco allegedly paid for Kozlowski's $30 million New York City apartment, the $6,000 shower curtains, and half the $2 million cost of the birthday party. It is shocking to realize the extent to which we have all been hoodwinked by the robber barons of our time, and by the very governmental bodies that are charged with preventing such mistreatment. It is hard for Americans to admit that we have been so blindsided that we have, in fact, tacitly encouraged these outrageous attacks on our economic and political systems. We have placed abusive CEOs on pedestals, glorifying their excessive wealth, multiple mansions, mega yachts, and luxurious private jets. We celebrate them like heroes instead of condemning them for pathological actions that have turned capitalism away from its creative potentials. For several decades, we have empowered these people, almost exclusively men, to create a system that is scandalously wasteful, overtly reckless, and, we see now, ultimately self-destructive. Perhaps more than any other single factor, today's tycoons exemplify the nature of the mutant form of capitalism we have misguidedly embraced and been infected with, the exploitation of the many by the few. We laud corporate executives who take advantage of workers and consumers alike, us, who openly manipulate Congress and then have the gall to brag about it. In such an unbalanced view of economics, we accept as natural that the CEOs of Fortune 500 companies become as rich as the Gilded Age tycoons simply because they operate under the mantle of publicly traded companies that are supposedly scrutinized by the Securities and Exchange Commission, SEC. We fail to object when we learn that roughly half the profits made by investment banks were distributed to the senior partners, not to the employees or the stockholders. We continue to honor the billionaires, even after we learn that many among them, such as Bernard Madoff, R. Allen Stanford, and the hundreds of executives on Wall Street and at companies like Enron, were complete frauds and charlatans, and that the whole system was rigged and rotten. We often justify the unscrupulous actions of modern robber barons because they contribute money to philanthropy and the arts. Yet in this, too, they are emulating a pattern that reaches back for more than a century. Jay Cook was deeply involved in financial scandals that brought down Canadian Prime Minister Sir John A. Macdonald in 1873, even though Cook professed to be a devout Christian who tithed 10% of his income to charity and helped build Episcopal churches. Daniel Drew made fortunes by manipulating stock prices, and he is credited with coining the term watered stock. But he was a devout Methodist who supported churches and founded Drew Theological Seminary, which is now part of Drew University. Henry Clay Frick, vilified for his amoral lifestyle and ruthless business dealings, was named by Portfolio Magazine, now defunct, as one of the worst American CEOs of all time. Yet he continues to be honored for his Frick collection of European art, which is celebrated as one of the finest in the United States. J.P. Morgan dominated corporate finance and industrial consolidation during his time, brokering the merger of companies that formed General Electric in 1892, and another amalgamation that became the monopolistic giant United States Steel Corporation in 1901. Yet he also raised money to finance a floundering U.S. Treasury during the 1895 recession, and came to the economy's rescue again in the panic of 1907. Among his philanthropies, Morgan helped to establish the Metropolitan Museum of Art in New York City, of which he was president, and the Wadsworth Athenaeum of Hartford, Connecticut. But does that somehow justify bringing on the financial ills of the New York, New Haven, and Hartford Railroad, and for steering the entire U.S. economy away from manufacturing and into a dangerous emphasis on finance? J.P. Morgan set a course that has been followed by many of today's billionaires, of mergers, acquisitions, and consolidations, deals that heap riches on those who mold them, but wreak havoc on competitors, workers, and local economies. These transactions empower a few individuals with control of resources and markets. The CEOs who end up at the top of the conglomerates are in positions to exert excessive influence over government officials, the press, and buying trends. Because such deals are made on paper, in boardrooms, law offices, and at investment banks, they seldom produce tangible goods or services. And, as we all know, paper transactions have played an ever-increasing role in the U.S. economy in recent decades. They are a major part of the predatory capitalism that has brought our economy crashing down. Stephen Alan Schwarzman is a direct descendant of the Morgan heritage, and in many respects he epitomizes this new wave of robber barons. Born just after the end of World War II, He graduated from Yale University 1 year after George W. Bush. Both were members of the Skull and Bone Society. He then went on to Harvard Business School, rose to managing director of Lehman Brothers at the age of 31, and eventually co-founded and served as chairman of the Blackstone Group, a private equity firm that focused on mergers and acquisitions. Schwartzman enjoyed an estimated annual income of around $400 million and a net worth of more than $7 billion in 2008. He makes no attempt to hide his lavish lifestyle. With typical panache, he celebrated his 60th birthday on February 13, 2007, at New York City's Park Avenue Armory. Guests included former Secretary of State Colin Powell, Mayor of New York City Michael Bloomberg, Cardinal Edward M. Egan, Sony Chairman and CEO Sir Howard Stringer, former New Yorker editor Tina Brown, former Governor of New York George E. Pataki, Chief Executive of the NYSE Group, which operates the New York Stock Exchange, John Thane, Donald and Melania Trump, and ABC anchor Barbara Walters. The evening climaxed with live performances by Rod Stewart and Patti LaBelle. The New York Times summed up the event this way. The festivities served as a coronation of sorts for Mr. Schwartzman, a billionaire several times over, an active Republican donor, and chairman of the Kennedy Center in Washington, whose influence reaches deep into the worlds of finance, politics, and the arts. In addition to his role at the Kennedy Center, Schwartzman has served as an adjunct professor at the Yale School of Management. On March 11, 2008, he announced that he was contributing $100 million toward the expansion of the New York Public Library, where he also was a trustee. The function of philanthropy is a fascinating one. As a founder and board member of several nonprofits, I have had to come to grips with questions of integrity around accepting donations from people who made their fortunes in activities that contradict the philosophies of the organizations they offer to support. It is impossible, of course, to comprehend philanthropists' true motives, which range from assuaging their own feelings of guilt to duping the public into believing in their inherent sense of compassion to genuinely desiring to do good. However, from a purely economic perspective, philanthropy is inefficient. A person who has accumulated billions of dollars and in doing so has caused others to lose their jobs, close the doors of small businesses, or ravage the environment, and then donates a small percentage of his fortune to correcting those problems or to the arts, would have served the world far better by making fewer profits while increasing employment, supporting small businesses, and insisting that his executives practice good environmental stewardship. Bill Gates is a case in point. Co-founder with Paul Allen and CEO of Microsoft, he can take credit for producing real goods, ones that revolutionized human societies, albeit by driving countless competitors and startups out of business and creating a virtual monopoly in desktop software. In the process, he amassed great wealth. He was ranked number one on Forbes' list of the world's richest people for more than a decade beginning in 1995. In 1999, his net worth surpassed $100 billion, inspiring the media to call him a centibillionaire. His company's position secured, he and his wife formed the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, the largest transparently operated charitable foundation in the world. This philanthropic organization appears to perform a vital function, focusing on global problems that are generally ignored by governments and NGOs. As a philanthropist, Bill Gates seems to be a man of impeccable integrity. His family had given nearly $30 billion to charity by 2008. Time magazine identified him as one of the 100 people who most influenced the 20th century, and dubbed him, along with his wife Melinda and rock band U2's lead singer Bono, as a 2005 Persons of the Year. Bill Gates was named CEO of the Year by Chief Executive Officers magazine and voted 8th in the list of Heroes of Our Time in 2006. However, The Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation has been severely criticized for investing its endowment in companies that are accused of contributing to poverty in the very third world countries where the foundation's stated goal is to relieve poverty. Such investments include pharmaceutical companies that refuse to sell their medicines to the developing world at appropriate prices, and a variety of corporations that contribute heavily to pollution. The foundation's response to public condemnation of these investments was to announce a review of its policies in 2007 and then to quietly issue a statement saying that its portfolio was based on maximizing returns, not judging corporate actions. As a young founder and CEO, Gates had a reputation for brutally beating down competitors. He and Microsoft have been attacked in many countries for business practices that at best are morally questionable and at worst illegal. Governments like Brazil's have threatened to boycott Microsoft products because of the company's ruthless tactics. Over its lifetime, Microsoft has faced hundreds of class action and other lawsuits. Antitrust litigation was successfully brought against Microsoft in both the United States and the European Union, accusing the company of monopolization, blocking competition, and, in the United States, of violating the Sherman Antitrust Act. The fine levied against Microsoft by the European Union of $613 million was the largest in EU regulator history. As I travel around the United States, I often hear students pointing to Bill Gates as a model of capitalism. "I can get rich," they say, "and then donate some of my money to good causes." My response to them, why not run a company that concentrates on improving social and environmental conditions through its daily operations instead? That's a lot more efficient and ultimately more satisfying. Like the robber barons who pioneered the development of the railroads, steel, and electrical appliances, Bill Gates has made stunning contributions to technology. And yet, like them, he has played a major role in widening the gap between rich and poor. Today, when the world is so much more integrated than it was a century ago, in part because of his products, the actions of people like him have far more serious implications than ever before. Lawrence Ellison is another high priest of high technology. His Oracle Corporation is the world's largest business software company. An avid sailor, he flaunts his wealth. His state-of-the-art racing boats have entered most major yachting competitions, including the America's Cup. He is co-owner, with music and film mogul David Geffen, of one of the world's largest and most luxurious private vessels. He collects rare cars, planes, and real estate. He received a lot of positive press when he donated $100 million to a charitable foundation. Then it was revealed that the foundation was his own, and the donation was made as part of a deal to settle an insider trading lawsuit arising from an Oracle stock transaction. He was further denounced for pledging $115 million to Harvard University and then reneging on his promise. Ellison's business practices have come under fire practically from the beginning. He admitted to developing a marketing and accounting strategy that grossly overstated Oracle's sales and earnings. In order to avoid bankruptcy, the company laid off roughly 10% of its workforce and settled class action lawsuits from disgruntled stockholders out of court. Gates and Ellison have become household names. But perhaps no one is more famous among corporate executives and MBA students than Jack Welch, the former chairman and CEO of General Electric, and a person often cited as the shining star for today's enlightened business person. At conferences where I speak, I hear his name cited more often than any other as a model of corporate leadership, despite the fact that he retired in 2001. It always sends shivers down my spine. To me, Welch is the quintessential symbol of the modern CEO as predatory capitalist. In the mid-1970s, when Welch was a vice president at GE, He vehemently fought the state of New York and environmental agencies that tried to force GE to clean up the extremely toxic PCBs its factories had dumped into the Hudson River. He ended up forging an agreement that limited GE's liability for PCB pollution to a mere $3 million. This victory helped propel him to the top of the organization, to the position of vice chairman in 1979, and then its youngest CEO in 1981. His reputation as a hard-nosed negotiator, at a time when there was a strong corporate backlash against laws that protected the environment, catapulted him to national recognition. Seldom mentioned was the fact that GE workers and their families were among those most seriously impacted by the toxic waters that flowed through their communities. GE employees nicknamed Welch Neutron Jack, in reference to the neutron bomb, in the 1980s because he ruthlessly eliminated employees and left buildings intact. In his book, Jack, Straight from the Gut, he boasts that GE had around 410,000 employees at the end of 1980, and that he had reduced it to just about 299,000 by the end of 1985. Although he is credited with making the organization lean and mean, the truth is that he put more than a quarter of his employees out of work, while his bonuses and net worth soared. In the 1990s, Welch modernized GE by shifting its emphasis from manufacturing to financial services. That strategy was a major driver behind the U.S. economy's unhealthy transformation from production to paper. I tell the attendees of those corporate and MBA conferences, if you want to honor Jack Welch, give him credit for being one of the chief architects of our current environmental and economic crises. In an ironic twist of fate, Welch's PCB victories in the 1970s came back to haunt him. The U.S. Environmental Protection Agency in 2000, after 16 years of study, announced a Hudson River cleanup plan that would cost GE $460 million. Welch retired from GE the following year. Next in line among America's most famous executives in recent decades is Sam Walton, founder of Walmart. He is honored as revolutionizing the retail business. Today, no company in the world sells to more people than Walmart. No company reaches so many corners of the planet. No company in the United States employs as many people. And no company has been more criticized by consumer advocates, environmental NGOs, community organizers, women's rights groups, and labor unions. Among the complaints? Walmart's poor employee health insurance policies, outsourcing to foreign labor markets, defiance of unions, sexism, management efforts at coercing employees to vote for specific parties during national elections, and strategies to close down local businesses whose owners either join campaigns to keep Walmart out of their communities or are viewed as competitors. Sam Walton was ranked as the wealthiest man in the United States from 1985 to 1988. By the time he died in 1992, he had created a family dynasty that recalls the dynasties established by John D. Rockefeller and the royal families of Europe and Asia. Daughter Alice, sons Jim and S. Robson, and daughter-in-law Christy, widow of son John, individually consistently rank among the world's 20 richest people. Their combined wealth would almost certainly put them at the top of the list. Michael Bloomberg may be the corporatocracy's current poster boy. After receiving an MBA from Harvard, he joined Solomon Brothers as a trader and later became a general partner. When he left the firm, he used his $10 million severance pay to create a financial information company, Bloomberg LP, that expanded to include news services, a magazine, cable network, and radio stations. He was elected mayor of New York City in 2001 and again in 2005. With a net worth estimated at over $15 billion, he is listed among the United States' 10 wealthiest people and has reportedly donated around $800 million to charity and the arts. He declines to receive a salary as mayor and lives in his own home on the Upper East Side instead of Gracie Mansion, the official mayor's residence. He also owns homes in Britain and the tax haven of Bermuda. He has often been mentioned in political circles as a potential presidential candidate. There is, however, a shadow side of Michael Bloomberg. It includes an Equal Employment Opportunity Commission, EEOC, class action lawsuit against his company for harassment of women, accusations by labor that he busts unions, and the fact that he financed his political campaigns with an estimated $150 million of his own money, giving him a huge advantage over his opponents. He is the archetype of the revolving door executive, one of those powerful people like former Treasury Secretaries Robert Rubin and Hank Paulson, who shuttle back and forth between business, government, and banking, and in the process ensure that their interests are always served, regardless of the impacts on the general economy. The list of predatory capitalists is extensive. Among other noteworthy corporatocracy billionaires, John T. Chambers, chairman of the board and CEO of Cisco Systems, Inc. Scott McNeely, chairman of the board of Sun Microsystems. Charles Koch, chairman of the board and CEO of Koch Industries, Inc., a conglomerate with major oil and gas facilities and the largest privately held company by revenue in the United States. Charles' brother and co-owner, David Koch. Michael Dell, the founder and CEO of Dell, Inc., and Ronald Perelman, who bought beleaguered corporations and then sold them for enormous profits. Among his most infamous deals is the purchase of Revlon Corporation with $700 million in junk bonds from Michael Milken's now-defunct Drexel Burnham Lambert. All told, there were 355 billionaires in the United States, 45% of the world's total, in 2008. They were worth more than $1 trillion. One thing about most of them is clear. They do not include among their goals that of being responsible citizens willing to help the workers and consumers who enable them to gain their riches. Although these members of the corporatocracy make a show of publicly supporting philanthropies, at the same time, they quietly expend fortunes on lawyers and lobbyists who fight against pro-labor, pro-consumer, and pro-environment regulations and any laws that would force the tycoons to pay their fair share of taxes. Those with the money and power go to great lengths to cheat the system. According to the U.S. Government Accountability Office, GAO, nearly two-thirds of the companies they own and manage do not pay any income taxes at all, despite their profitability and combined revenues of about $2.5 trillion. The corporatocracy's lobbying efforts have been extremely successful for its members personally and disastrous for the economy as a whole. The percentage of federal taxes paid by corporations dropped from 40% of the total in 1943 to 7% in 2003. At the other end of the U.S. spectrum are the impoverished. The official U.S. Census reports that almost 40 million people in the United States live below the poverty level. Nearly 46 million people in the United States did not have health insurance in 2007, and that figure undoubtedly rose in 2008 and 2009 due to the recession. The contrast between the extremely wealthy and the destitute is something few Americans want to talk about, and yet it is a very real contributor to our current economic demise. In our literature and movies, we poke fun at banana republics, but the sad truth is that we are perhaps the world's first non-banana-producing banana republic. When we examine the state of our economy, the shortage of businesses that produce real things that people need, the huge gap between rich and poor, the current national debt, and the exploitation of the many by a very few, we see a profile similar to that in the Third World. Our overall standards may be higher. However, in relative terms, the similarities are shocking, and every year, things grow worse. In terms of U.S. wealth distribution, the 10% at the top of the economic ladder own nearly 90% of stocks, bonds, trust funds, and business equity, and over 75% of non-home real estate. According to G. William Domhoff, professor of sociology at the University of California at Santa Cruz, since financial wealth is what counts as far as the control of income-producing assets, we can say that just 10% of the people own the United States of America. The conclusion that a very few people exercise undue influence over the rest of us is not a pretty one. It does not reflect the way most of us are raised to think of ourselves or our system. As the short biographies above demonstrate, that small handful of people controls technology, vital energy resources, the media, the banks, and the government. It is also shocking to realize that these people so mismanaged the system that they drove us all into the terrible economic recession we now face. They themselves would have been better off if they had hired fewer lawyers and instead doled out more money to the poor through both increased employment and tax-supported government programs. The recipients could then have become consumers. However, predatory capitalists apparently were not capable of understanding this most basic economic principle. And we, the people, went along with them. We idolized their jets, yachts, and mansions. We honored their philanthropies and their pious words. We turned our resources over to them and elected them and their advisors to public offices. One has to wonder how a country that fought a revolution against British aristocracy allowed itself to fall so far. In a very real sense, the modern Gilded Age of robber barons started with deregulation of the energy sector, about the time I chose to enter that industry after leaving the EHM ranks. Chapter 8. The Coming Deregulation. I'd have to build you a volcano to burn that stuff, an engineer who was an expert in coal-fired electric power generation told me in 1984. We were standing together at the site of an old coal mine outside Scranton, Pennsylvania, peering up at a mountain of coal, the tailings discarded years earlier as non-combustible waste, the last stage of the coal extraction process. Then build me a volcano. I was CEO of Independent Power Systems, Inc., IPS, a company founded by an engineer, a real estate developer who put up $1 million in seed money, and me in response to the deregulation of the energy sector. The first step in deregulation came in the form, ironically, of new regulation. Despite its name, the Public Utility Regulatory Policies Act, PURPA, was a movement away from regulations. It was passed by the U.S. Congress in 1978 because of the energy crises that had ripped through the industrialized world. The intent was to change the electric utility companies in a way that, it was assumed, would reduce dependence on imported oil, diversify the industry, increase efficiency, and promote the development of alternative and renewable energy. PURPA created a market for non-utility energy producers by forcing power companies to purchase electricity from independents at the avoided cost, the price the utility would incur by generating energy from its normal sources, generally oil or coal. PURPA was challenged by several utilities, but the Supreme Court voted to uphold it. These decisions opened the door for companies like IPS. Our mission was to develop environmentally beneficial power plants that earned decent returns for our investors. Although IPS incorporated soon after the 1980 elections, we did not open our offices until after the Supreme Court's favorable 1982 ruling. The engineer scratched his head. "You're kidding." "Not at all. I picked up a chunk of black coal, legally classified as a waste. It had been abandoned in piles like this one that leached dangerous toxins into the land and water." I turned to him. Build me a volcano that doesn't produce acid rain. He shook his head slowly, as though he thought I was crazy. Nevertheless, he and a team of engineers did exactly that. Utilizing a fluidized bed technology that had been employed in Ireland to burn cow manure, they designed a boiler that, on paper, would convert calm into electricity. At that point, though, it was merely theoretical. My job as CEO and former EHM was to arrange the financing. It was a major challenge, given that this was an unproven technology. I spent sleepless nights and endless weeks on Wall Street trying to convince large institutional investors to trust us with their funds. Of the 84 PURPA-driven independent power companies registered in the states where we worked, all but 7 folded. However, by the end of the decade, we had built and were operating one of the first acid rain-free plants in the world to be powered by coal, waste coal at that. In addition, instead of sending excess heat into cooling ponds or towers, we pumped it into hydroponic greenhouses that raised flowers year-round in Pennsylvania. We filled in old pit mines with the ash from the burned comb, and we planted trees in an attempt to revitalize the land. The 6 other surviving companies sold out to large engineering conglomerates. IPS was the lone exception. I like to think that my hard work and managerial talents made the difference. Yet I have to confess that people in high places who owed favors to a former EHM contributed to our success. In those days, acid rain was considered the biggest environmental deterrent to burning coal. The dangers of carbon dioxide accumulation were barely discussed. In retrospect, such an oversight is shocking. It strikes me now that the oil companies were determined back then to keep information about greenhouse gases under wraps. IPS's success in alleviating acid rain was hailed by environmentalists as a major breakthrough. We set new standards for the industry. We were cited by the U.S. House of Representatives and written up in the Congressional Record as an example of American ingenuity and entrepreneurship. That whole experience taught me a great deal about deregulation. Although my professors at Boston University had praised the regulatory policies of Franklin D. Roosevelt, as an EHM, I had been surrounded by people who favored fewer restrictions. My initial success at IPS convinced me that my professors had been misled. It seemed to me that deregulation opened the door to innovation and offered an opportunity for the small guy to compete in a larger arena. I was in for a shock. A subsidiary of Ashland Oil Company had built our comb-burning plant under a turnkey contract. That is, a contract that specified that the plant was to be completed for a fixed price within a specific time frame and according to strict performance standards. The task turned out to be much tougher than anyone had anticipated. In fact, the Ashland subsidiary failed to perform, and its management tried to break the contract. Fortunately for us, our lawyers had made it airtight. The subsidiary ended up tearing out the original boiler and hiring a German firm to build a new one. They exceeded their budget by nearly 30%. Ashland's CEO was livid. Finally, the plant went online. Soon after that, Ashland told us that they intended to buy us out. It was their only shot at recouping their losses. I sat in a meeting with a dour Ashland lawyer, accompanied by 2 burly men who did not offer business cards. The attorney informed us that they could make life difficult if we refused their offer. He gave no specifics, just droned on about the slowness of the court system. Meanwhile, I had visions of a graphic scene from The Godfather. A Hollywood mogul who refused to cooperate with Don Corleone woke up to find the severed, bloody head of his prized racehorse in bed next to him. Our lawyers assured us that we would probably win the court battle, but until that happened, the court would close down the plant and it would not generate the income required to pay our debts. The case could be dragged out for months, exactly the point Ashland's lawyer had been making while I was visualizing horseflesh. Without the revenues from selling electricity, we would be forced into bankruptcy and lose everything. Shackled by debt, it was a language I understood. I took a long walk on the beach that evening. I thought about my daughter Jessica, a tender 7-year-old. The next morning, I met with my partners. We decided to sell. I called my lawyer at Chadburn and Park. "I think it is your only option," he agreed. "These guys play hardball." A few days later, I sat in an office with Joe Cogan, the partner who had put up the initial $1 million, and Joe's personal lawyer, awaiting a call from Ashland's CEO. Joe was a pugnacious South Florida real estate developer. About 5'4", he was famous among local construction crews as the guy who showed up with a baseball bat whenever they fell behind schedule. He would shake the bat in the face of their supervisor and scream, "If this job isn't done on time, I'll skin your hide." Now he paced around the room, occasionally glaring at the phone, growling and fuming, and giving me belligerent looks. I could tell he was prepared to fight. About 10 minutes later, the call came through. Joe's lawyer punched the button on the speakerphone. Ashland's CEO said, "Hello." Without another formality, not so much as "how are you," he stated a price. It was absurdly low. Joe rushed to the phone. "That's an insult," he shouted. "You can take the whole goddamn project and flush it down the toilet." The phone went dead. The CEO had hung up on us. Joe marched out of the room and slammed the door behind him. I have to admit that I was terrified at that moment. I was 44 years old and was certain that if we did not strike a deal with Ashland, I would never find another job, except perhaps on one of the construction crews that built condominiums for Joe. But there was nothing I could do except sit and wait. Within the hour, Joe's attorney received a phone call from an Ashland lawyer. The tactic had worked. They were ready to negotiate. It turned out to be a lucrative deal for all three of us partners. Nonetheless, I was terribly disappointed. I had intended to build a career from that project. Instead, I was forced out of the business. Although IPS accomplished the stated objectives of PURPA, in the final analysis, we were merely a pawn for a big oil company. They had used us to help them develop a new technology, and then they pushed us aside. I have come to believe that the budget overrun was just an excuse, that they had always planned on owning the plant. Their tactics amounted to the legal equivalent of extortion. Similar things had happened to the other developers. Joe Cogan and I had lunch together a couple of months after Ashland bought us out. He talked about cowboy movies he had seen in his youth. He recalled that Ronald Reagan had starred in a couple of them. "So many of those films," he said, "were about the terrible fate of people in towns where there was no law, or the sheriff was the corrupt puppet of some rancher baron. The hero would ride in on a white horse and bring order to the place." He set down his fork and stared at me. "Seems like this deregulation idea is just a justification for lawlessness. Reagan turns out to be the corrupt sheriff, not the guy on the white horse." In lawless places, the strong and ruthless rule. A major reason for having a legal system is to protect the weak and defenseless. Whether in towns of the Wild West or modern-day Afghanistan, the absence of laws or people to enforce them is tantamount to assuring that might will prevail over right. I discovered the hard way that deregulation did not open the door to innovation. It did not offer an opportunity for the small guy to compete in the larger arena. It created that impression and then used it as a means to help the strong flex their muscles. Consumers were the ultimate losers. They ended up paying much higher prices in many states while experiencing serious shortages in electricity supplies, including blackouts that devastated many small businesses. Some communities were forced to divert tax monies from educational, health care, and other social programs so they could bail out failed power systems. The jackals had come home to roost. The Enron scam is an example everyone knows. Another is the entire state of California. After investigating the fiasco surrounding Democratic Governor Gray Davis and the electric utility scandal in California, the nation on February 12, 2001 concluded, "Blackouts, brownouts, and soaring electricity rates have defined the political landscape of California since last spring. They've transformed the phrase utility deregulation into a household epithet, and they've helped create a crisis whose economic and ecological shockwaves will carry deep into the new century." Electric usage during the year running from June 2000 to June 2001 was reduced by an unprecedented 14%. Governor Davis was recalled from office and was succeeded by Republican Arnold Schwarzenegger. The California economy never recovered, all because of lax or shelved regulations and emasculated enforcers. In the end, PURPA was a boon to the big utility companies. These once regulated monopolies that were restricted to specific geographic areas have expanded and become parts of mammoth unregulated holding companies. Florida Power and Light, FPL, for example, created the FPL Group as its holding company. It still operates in its original territory, and it also owns hydroelectric plants in Maine, solar units in California and Arizona, and wind farms in 21 states and Canada. Duke Power restructured itself as Duke Energy. In addition to its original North Carolina operations, it now also owns facilities in Canada and Latin America. Baltimore Gas and Electric created Constellation Power, which, according to its website, April 2009, is a major generator of electricity with a diversified fleet of power plants strategically located throughout the United States, as well as in its original franchise area in Maryland. IPS gave me firsthand experience with the impacts of deregulation. PURPA was, in many respects, a test case. It was followed by a flood of laws that negated rules and regulations established during the Great Depression, and it supercharged the mutant form of capitalism. Chapter 9. The Regulation Scam. Some industries have to be heavily regulated or they'll self-destruct, Professor Ashton used to tell us in our BU Business School classes. In addition to wanting us to become executives with integrity, he hoped to impress upon us that unlimited competition is not always healthy. "Whenever a lot of capital is involved," he lectured, "too much competition can be disastrous." The railroads were his favorite example of a business that had been thrown into turmoil by the ruthless drive of the old train tycoons to keep government off their backs. They cheated, robbed each other and the public, and did just about everything else to win their crazy game of monopoly, he would say, wagging his head in disdain. The railroads were crippled or died as a result. He worried that the airline industry was following the same course. "If U.S. airlines aren't heavily regulated," he pointed out, "or even government-owned, as in so many other countries, if a number of them are instead allowed to compete for the same routes, with ticket prices up for grabs, it'll be disastrous." Professor Ashton seemed to anticipate the emergence of Milton Friedman's theories and was attempting to counter his arguments even before they were made public. I know Professor Ashton was very familiar with Ludwig von Mises and Friedrich von Hayek, two economists who influenced Friedman's work. Mises, one of the most important economists and social philosophers of the mid-20th century, argued fervently in favor of laissez-faire markets. Hayek devoted himself to free market capitalism. He shared the 1974 Nobel Memorial Prize in Economics with Gunnar Myrdal and, like Friedman, He was instrumental in shaping the policies of both Margaret Thatcher and Ronald Reagan. When Thatcher was asked what economic theory most influenced her, she reached into her briefcase, pulled out Hayek's The Constitution of Liberty, held it above her head, and proclaimed, "This is the Bible." It must have disturbed Professor Ashton immensely that transportation along with electricity were the first sectors to be deregulated in the United States since the New Deal. President Richard Nixon proposed to Congress in late 1971 to open both rail and truck transportation to more lenient practices. Gerald Ford hammered through the Railroad Revitalization and Regulatory Reform Act of 1976. Jimmy Carter lobbied Congress to pass the Airline Deregulation Act in 1978 and the Staggers Rail Act and Motor Carrier Act in 1980. Combined, these deregulation successes reversed trends that had begun in the late 1880s. In each case, they allowed competitors to undercut each other's prices. They ultimately drove many companies to ruin. The role that liberal Democrats played in the deregulation frenzy is an indication of the influence wielded by Mises, Hayek, and Friedman. President Carter was converted by a Democratic and liberal economist, Alfred Kahn, who is considered an expert in airline regulation and was ultimately nicknamed the father of airline deregulation. As chairman of the Civil Aeronautics Board, he paved the way for low-cost carriers from People Express to Southeast Airlines, and he oversaw the demise of the agency he headed. Dozens of airlines folded as a result of deregulation, including People Express, Southeast, and TWA. A landslide of failures in related businesses followed. Food caterers, travel agencies, parts suppliers, and others that serviced the defunct airlines, as well as those impacted by the job losses suffered by pilots, flight attendants, mechanics, and luggage handlers. Many other major companies that had prospered under the former regulated policies filed for bankruptcy, including Delta, Northwest Airlines, United, U.S. Airways, and Continental. Daniel Engber wrote in a 2005 Slate article entitled, "Why Do Airlines Go Bankrupt?" Airlines almost never went bankrupt in the old days, when a federal board controlled every aspect of the industry, including ticket prices and routes. The board would also step in when an airline was about to go under. That kind of government oversight ended with the United States Airline Deregulation Act of 1978, which opened the runways to upstart competitors. Airlines seem to go bankrupt more often than any other business, but companies in other deregulated industries, like telecommunications, have followed a similar pattern in recent years. In the deregulated aviation industry, airline tickets are like a commodity. Since multiple carriers serve the same routes, customers will go with whoever's the cheapest. Despite the mounting evidence of the harm inflicted, the movement to dispose of rules governing businesses had many advocates. "Deregulation is the wave of the future," Paul Priddy, Maine's president in 1978, told a group of us over lunch. Priddy's limited government philosophy reflected that of former Maine president Jake Dauber. "Unrestricted business is our answer to communism. It is time for every one of you," he waved his arms around the room, "to hop on the bandwagon. Deregulate, deregulate, deregulate." Consulting organizations like Maine actively promoted deregulation throughout the 1970s and 1980s, as did the Brookings Institution, the American Enterprise Institute, and other Washington think tanks. If you were stubborn enough to stick to the beliefs of the likes of Professor Ashton, you were seen as unpatriotic. In my heart, I felt corporations needed legal restrictions. By the time Priddy made that statement, I had 7 years of EHM experience. I knew that corruption reigned, at least among U.S. corporations working in the Third World. From a philosophical point of view, it seemed to me that in a democracy, rules were needed to defend the majority. Truly democratic elections would keep in power those leaders who supported laws that protected us from corporate abuses and economic turmoil. Any attempts on the part of corporations to lobby or bribe politicians to loosen restrictions and thereby place us in jeopardy were not in the best interests of the majority, and therefore, by their very nature, were undemocratic. I once raised this idea with a group of fellow partners at Maine. The looks I received strongly suggested that if I valued my job, I should keep such opinions to myself. My heart yielded to my head and my professional ambition. However, it was the beginning of the end for me, one of the factors that convinced me to quit my job a few years later. One act of Congress followed another. Interstate buses were deregulated under the Bus Regulatory Reform Act of 1982. Freight aggregators in the Surface Freight Forwarder Deregulation Act of 1986, shipping in the Ocean Shipping Act of 1984, and the Ocean Shipping Reform Act of 1998. I often thought back to my early training with Claudine. "Something important for you to continually do," she advised me, "is to convince leaders in the countries where you work to loosen laws that govern corporations." We were walking down the promenade in the center of Commonwealth Avenue, one of the few occasions when we abandoned her apartment and ventured out into public. She was wearing a headscarf that covered most of her face and a long, baggy overcoat, intended to convince anyone from Maine who might happen by that she was a dowdy aunt from Vermont. "Let them know that their take will increase every time they cut back on rules that protect the environment, tax our corporations, or increase wages." We walked past a man seated on a bench reading the Boston Globe. "There's the shadow of your nemesis," she said, pointing at the newspaper. "We don't want to see the cross-ownership rule spread to places like Indonesia and Iran." She was referring to the latest law to take effect in a push toward diversity in media ownership that had begun in the 1960s. These laws had come about primarily in response to the growing influence exerted by television and as a reaction against the negative impacts on news outlets caused by Senator Joseph McCarthy's Red Scare hearings. The assumption made by the diversity advocates was that the more entities involved in media ownership, the greater the likelihood that the American public would receive unbiased information. In 1964, the local TV multiple ownership rule had been passed. It prohibited a single entity from owning several television stations in any given market, unless there were more than 8 stations within the market. The radio TV cross-ownership rule of 1970 prevented companies from operating a television and radio station in the same market. Similarly, the ownership of both a broadcast television station and a newspaper was barred in 1975. These laws were portrayed by their proponents as contemporary cornerstones to freedom of the press. The opposition argued that restricting businesses from freely participating in an open market to buy and sell media outlets was unconstitutional. Whenever I heard politicians espouse the latter, I thought about Claudine. She was never so hypocritical as to wrap her policies in fancy principles. She wanted corporations to control the press simply because it gave them power. Claudine sighed, one. Deregulation under Reagan opened the door for media companies to enjoy what amounted to monopolistic control. The first Bush administration sought to end the Fairness Doctrine, a Federal Communications Commission, FCC, policy that required the holders of broadcast licenses to present controversial issues of public importance in an honest, equitable, and balanced manner. In Meredith Corp. v. FCC, 1987, the courts ruled that the FCC was not responsible for regulating the Fairness Doctrine. The doctrine was abolished that same year. The Telecommunications Act, passed under President Clinton in 1996, led to a wave of acquisitions and mergers, to decreased competition, to a significant decline in the number of commercial radio stations, and to substantial increases in the average prices charged by cable companies to their clients. The deregulation wave throughout the media sector has radically reduced the number of media companies. As I mentioned in Chapter 3, 50 corporations controlled the vast majority of all news media in the United States in 1983. By 2004, this had dropped to 6. Time Warner, Disney, which owns ABC, Murdoch's News Corporation, Bertelsmann, Viacom, formerly CBS, and General Electric, NBC. Deregulation in the communications industry may have stimulated the greatest public debate, at least in part, because the media itself was directly affected. However, from the standpoint of the current economic crises, the most damaging impacts were generated by changes in the banking, financial, and insurance sectors. Officials charged with bringing us out of the Great Depression had recognized the need for large-scale reform in the laws that govern those who manage our money. They had witnessed the terrible consequences of banking abuses, and they consequently implemented a number of regulations to prevent such things from being repeated. The most significant was the Glass-Steagall Act of 1933 that prohibited a single company from offering investment banking, commercial banking, and insurance services. It was complemented by many other regulations aimed at maintaining a stable economy. The reforms continued after World War II. Due to concerns that the banking industry was headed toward competition-reducing consolidations, the Bank Holding Company Act was passed under President Eisenhower in 1956. It specified that the Federal Reserve Board of Governors had to approve the establishment of a bank holding company. In addition, it prohibited a bank holding company headquartered in one state from purchasing a bank in another state, and it forbid banks from participating in most non-banking activities. The process was reversed with the advent of the free market craze. The interstate restrictions of the Bank Holding Company Act were repealed by the Regal-Neal Interstate Banking and Branching Efficiency Act of 1994. The Graham-Leach-Bliley Act of 1999 rescinded the parts of the Glass-Steagall Act that had not already been revoked. Clinton's economic team echoed the policies of Reagan and Bush. As Tom Hartman points out in his new book, Threshold, a few weeks before Bill Clinton was to be sworn into the office as President of the United States, he was visited by Goldman Sachs CEO Robert Rubin, who had just taken a $40 million paycheck from his last year with Goldman and would soon become the head of Clinton's economic team tasked with carrying out the New Covenant, and Alan Greenspan. The philosophy represented by Rubin and Greenspan doesn't believe in government as a solution to much of anything other than wars and crime. Governments, they told Clinton, would be replaced by economies made up largely of corporations operating outside the realm of government control. Money, capital, would be free to move anywhere in the world, although the movement of people, labor, would continue to be tightly restricted to maximize the potential for profit in any particular part of the New World marketplace. The idea of a nation as a sovereign entity answerable to its people was, in their view, quaint and outdated. People and nations existed, they believed, to serve economic forces, not the other way around. A direct consequence of these deregulatory actions was that the nation's largest banks purchased others. Mergers followed buyouts, and one consolidation after another occurred. The most notorious of these were the marriage of Citibank and Travelers Group, an insurance company, and the merging of Bank America Corp. with Nations Bank Corporation, which then became Bank of America, and bought out the seventh largest bank in the United States, Fleet Boston Financial, and the credit card giant MBNA. Such consolidations would have been impossible under Glass-Steagall. They ended up haunting the administrations of both George W. Bush and Barack Obama. When Ronnie Reagan slid off his white horse, Joe Kogan told me during the lunch we shared after we sold our company to Ashland Oil, and pinned on the corrupt sheriff's star, he opened the jail cell doors and released crooks and panhandlers. They're the high-class types wearing coats and ties, like the Ashland CEO. But don't let appearances fool you. They're just a bunch of thieves with no laws to stop them. As I read the headlines and watched the television news broadcasts in 2009, I kept thinking about Professor Ashton. If he is still alive, I can imagine that he is not too surprised about all the abuses we the people have endured because of the demolition of this body of regulatory laws that were established to protect us. Abandoning these laws has predictably led to the economic tsunami we are experiencing today. As my old BU professor used to say, some industries have to be heavily regulated or they'll self-destruct. Unfortunately, the push to deregulate was accompanied by a movement to legalize deceptive accounting. In their eagerness to enhance short-term profits, executives of our largest corporations devised a system that neglected to include some very significant real costs. The wife of one of the music world's most popular artists came face to face with the realities behind fake accounting in one of the planet's wildest and most pristine places. Chapter 10. Fake Accounting. Earlier, I talked about the 30,000 Ecuadorians who filed a lawsuit against Texaco, which has since been purchased by Chevron. The company had destroyed vast sections of rainforest, and the toxic wastes from its operations allegedly had killed many people and made thousands more chronically sick. It was horrible, Trudy Styler told several of us at dinner. Trudy had just returned from visiting the site. She and her husband, Sting, were avid supporters of the indigenous people who were taking a stand against the oil company. Like nothing I've ever seen before. Huge pools of oil that have been there for over 30 years. Birds coated in oil. Children covered with lesions and festering sores from the poisoned water. The children, so innocent, their lives ruined. She visibly shuddered. People are dying every week. How ironic that Ecuadorian citizens living on the nation's most valuable real estate are the poorest and most miserable in the country. And most of the consumers in the United States have no idea, Stephen Donziger added. A New York lawyer, he has devoted more than a decade to this case. That statement expresses a sad truth about so much of what is going on in the world today and the inadequacy of our accounting procedures to assign the true costs to products. Oil is a classic example of how those who sit on the resources are inadequately compensated, while those who consume them are charged prices that do not begin to cover the actual costs. Beyond the billions in cleanup expenditures, there are other costs associated with such a tragedy: the suffering, loss of human life, families destroyed, the potentials for real economic development sacrificed, and the animals and plants that are gone forever. Some might have offered cures for cancer, multiple sclerosis, and other diseases. I described the Ecuadorian case to a group of University of Wisconsin students one evening as we sat around a table at dinner. It raises the question, Sarah, an accounting major, said, of what Texaco would have done if they had been forced to apply true accounting rather than the fake number crunching we are all taught today. Externalities, another student interjected. Exactly, Sarah frowned. She glanced at the table. The contract was between the Ecuadorian government and Texaco. The indigenous people were barred from the negotiating table. Many costs are never taken into account when determining the price of the goods and services we consume. They are considered externalities. They include the social and environmental costs of the destruction of resources, the pollution, and the burdens on society of workers who become injured or ill and receive little or no health care, the indirect funding of companies that are permitted to market hazardous products, dump wastes into rivers or oceans, pay employees less than a living wage, provide substandard working conditions, extract natural resources from public lands at less than market prices, and receive public subsidies and exemptions. The massive advertising and lobbying campaigns, and the complex transportation and communications systems that are underwritten by taxpayers, and the executives' inflated salaries, bonuses, perks, and golden retirement parachutes that are written off as tax deductions. Since these costs do not directly impact the agreements signed by the contracting parties, they are simply ignored. However, many of them seriously impact third parties who are considered either irrelevant or too powerless to matter. They also contribute to the current global economic crises. Because so many resources are underpriced, they are wasted casually and depleted unnecessarily. Instead of recycling or using them more efficiently, we continue to drill, mine, extract, and manufacture with reckless abandon. One of the things that most upset the people of Iceland when I was there was that the cheap electricity provided to the aluminum smelters by their government deterred companies like Alcoa from investing in recycling programs. The Ecuadorian and Icelandic cases offer another example of how the mutant form of capitalism we have embraced has wreaked havoc on our economy. The mantra that the only responsibility of business is to make short-term profits has created an unrealistic and false set of accounting principles. Future generations looking back will hold us responsible for passing the costs on to them of forests devastated during oil operations, resources depleted, and hundreds of other factors that are conveniently ignored as externalities. For it is our children and grandchildren who will be left holding the bills. Proponents of this sort of deceptive accounting maintain that there is no alternative, that we cannot measure such factors, but that simply is not true. We have to estimate the values for some of these costs, Sarah admitted, but accountants do that all the time. Our system of depreciation is based on estimated life expectancies. So, too, is the amortization of intangible assets like goodwill and the value of patents and trademarks. We can certainly arrive at a rational approach for quantifying the externalities, one that presents a level playing field for all participants. It is better to err somewhat in our estimates than simply to ignore such factors.